Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to episode 136 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago I gave up my life's dream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode, I thought, hey, let's celebrate the 40th anniversary of the start of the Style Council and that incredible release of the single Speak Like a Child, March the 11th, 1983. I really wanted to chat to somebody who knows what it's like to sing and perform that band's incredible songs live on stage to adoring audiences. And in the absence of Paul Weller for this podcast series so far, I turned to Darren Fletcher, the fella behind the Style Councillors, an incredible tribute to the mighty Style Council. Formed in 2013, the band have built a loyal fan base for the group, which was Paul Weller's musical home from 1983 to 1989, and where he wrote some of his finest pop songs. The band replicate the very best from the back catalogue, and not only do they replicate the vocal and the sound of the songs, but they also use the same original instruments to recreate the exact style and feel of the extensive original lineup, including that swirling Hammond organ, the Mick Talbot sound, and that classic horn section, the honorary count as well. They're as close as it actually gets to being back there back in the 1980s. Let's get into it. My very special guest, the Style Councillors, Darren Fletcher. Hey, Darren, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure, mate. It's a pleasure.
Now, look, Darren, I'm really excited about talking to you. I was thinking about this this morning, right? There are very few people in this world who know what it's like to be Paul Weller, in the sense that getting up on a big stage, performing to loads of people and singing those songs. And I think it's Russell Hastings, the Jam, from the Jam, and it's you.
There's probably lots and lots of guys that, you know, that play Paul's songs. And I can't confess that, you know, I know what it's like to be Paul. I'll say that off the, you know, right off. But in some kind of micro environment, I do get the idea of what it's like. And that was one of the reasons kind of that I did this in the first place. I guess like Russell started off in pub bands and then, you know, went round doing lots of pub gigs. And then eventually, you know, I was a big fan of Paul's music from way back. We started introducing those, and those were the songs that went down well. So we started making the set predominantly Jam and Paul Weller stuff in a 4-5 piece kind of environment. And they, it was, you know, we did that for maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And then I thought about the Style. Style Council was really my band. I got into the Jam at the end of their kind of career. I was just leaving school as they split. And I didn't get to see the Jam, but I was aware of them, and I bought a few of their records, but never got the chance to go. But the Style Council, 83, when they kicked off, was kind of the band I followed, and they just grabbed me, you know, the look, the sound, all swagger with it, you know, and their style, the way they went about things just, you know, caught my attention big time. And then, you know, fast forward to maybe 2013, 2014, I thought, I'll give this a go. I'd always liked the idea of playing in a band with brass. So, I did the kind of Jam stuff that we were doing in pubs, and we were doing it relentless, and it had got to a point where we were doing Going Underground 3 or 4 times a week. And I was, God, as great a song as it is, you know, that's probably enough for anybody. So, yeah, I kind of got a few musicians, put a few adverts out and got some different musicians in and put this band together and give it a go. And it came together, you know, one of the first rehearsals where we got some brass guys in, just the sound straight away lifted. And the Style Council was kind of a band that I wanted to be in. When I heard them and I went to see them lots of times, I thought that's the band I want to be in. And obviously that, you know, that couldn't happen in them days. You know, there was no social media. So kind of connecting with a band, it's a lot easier today. You can ping someone a message on social media and almost connect with them immediately. In them days, you know, you had to go and hang about outside, I guess, gig venues at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, hoping to catch a glimpse. And it was all mystical and magical. So that added to it, all that mystique added to it. And I thought that feeling when the Style Council were around, it was a pretty drab time for the UK. I remember I just started work. I was working in a factory environment. I'd just started an apprenticeship, but I saw all the politics and was on the radio, the miners' strike, the Falklands War. It was a pretty drab time. And the Style Council crowd were kind of like a club. And I felt it was kind of like you belong to it, you know, by being a fan. And the idea of this, doing this tribute to it was to try and recreate that primarily for myself, you know, to recreate that kind of feeling of a group and hopefully give some people that were fans like me the chance to come and just have a nice night out and listen to those tunes again, put your white Levi's on and come and have a dance and, you know, just recapture a little bit of what I felt back in the early 80s. That was the plan, yeah.
Well, look, with 40 years now on since the creation of that band, that starts Speak Like a Child, right? So, and we'll take you back to those first gigs, all your memories of hearing those first songs and things. But as you were saying that, hearing the about the strikes on the radio and the Falklands War, I mean, here we are 40 years later and there's the war in Ukraine. We've got everybody on strike, it would appear, this and this cost of living crisis and inflation and all that. These lyrics that you're singing still mean something, don't they? So, and does that matter to you as somebody who's singing them, that actually it's not just a nice sound and it's not just these are jolly things to sing along to, but actually there's meaning behind the words that Paul was writing in the Style Council often?
Big time. I mean, I can't honestly say that when I'm singing, I'm thinking about the effect they'll have. You know, I can't say that because the songs are kind of ingrained in me now. I've been a fan of those songs so long. I can't really say that I feel about them the same way that Paul and Mick did when they wrote those songs. But one song that goes down well is Homebreakers that we've recently started doing again. I often say, you know, we've recently started playing this again due to the kind of economic climate we find ourselves in. This really strikes a chord. And that one song, the lyrics I do think about, and possibly Walls as well, you know, they're two of the most prominent ones, I guess. They've obviously got a real strong meaning. And they meant a lot at the time, you know, which is one of the reasons I love Paul's stuff. The storytelling and the message behind his songs is so clever. The way he interweaves the words with a melody. If you read them on a page, they don't rhyme, some of them. You think it's more like a poem than a song. And then he puts it to a melody and it sounds like the first time you hear these songs, it sounds like you've heard them before. The melodies are so strong, you know, and you don't often find that with other bands. You know, I listen to lots of bands, but Paul's got this enviable ability to sing such a strong melody and get a strong message across in such a clever way. It's really impressive. And to this day, yeah, it's fantastic.
Are there songs that are more challenging than others? I mean, immediately I'm thinking something like Money Go Round, for instance. Are there songs that you won't attempt because actually to do that live is like, that's too difficult?
Well, we do Money Go Round. Yeah, we do Money Go Round. Well, we've probably had a crack at, you know, 90% of the tricky songs, some of which Paul never played live. I don't believe he played live at a Top People's Health Farm. But, you know, the guys that play the brass for us, they're great players and they've written the parts out and, you know, we've got an arrangement. So, you know, it sounds really strong. The ones that I kind of shy away from are the ones where there's like, you know, the vocals are really tricky. They're really, you know, I'm no Paul in the vocal stakes.
But some of them are pretty high, right?
They're the ones that are challenging. Yeah, I'm kind of 50s knocking 50.
I think he avoids those now as well, yeah.
Yeah, and he was 18 when he was, you know, like early 20s at least when he was singing those. So, yeah, so it can be a bit of a challenge, yeah.
Now, take me back to those singles then. So when those first singles, that first run of singles before Café Bleu arrived, and they were knocking out of the park, weren't they, with those? What did they mean to you, getting those 7 inches, those 12 inches, and what are your memories of those days? And that first gig, I'd love to hear about that as well.
The songs, when Speak Like a Child came out, you know, it was all a bit mysterious, because all that the advertising blurb was a black sleeve with just the yellow. So you didn't know who was in the band. For the lack of social media, all you saw was what was in Melody Maker or NME back in the day. And so it was all a bit of a mystery, you know, and you was kind of on a Thursday night, hoping they'd make Top of the Pop so you could see who was actually playing on the record. You know, for me, there's obviously back then there was a lot of people that was in the know, but I wasn't one of them. You know, I was one of those that was waiting to see. Back then, records meant a lot more than they did. I think I've heard a few other people say this. Back then, you couldn't wait for the release date, and you went along to the record shop and you bought this new single. And if it had a 12-inch to go with it, you'd buy that. You know, you'd read all the blurb on the back, and particularly the Style Council songs. They had a little thing going with a cappuccino kid, you know, to string you along. And then the albums came along, the gatefolds, and they were just like pieces of art in themselves. It was an excitement to get the record and put it on. And sit and read through the lyrics and you know, read through the literature that came with it. That's sadly lacking today. You know, it's not the sort of thing you do with, you know, your Apple Play and your...
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because even today, there are a couple of albums out that I'm really looking forward to listening to and started this morning. But I asked the speaker in the corner to start playing. Yeah. You know, I'm not sat here looking at anything. Nothing's in my hand because the vinyl, I probably have ordered the vinyl, but the vinyl was delayed like everything else, you know. But you haven't got that physical thing to kind of spend time with it and get engrossed in it and read the... And I couldn't tell you what the words are half the time, you know, initially. It just takes repeat listens. I love that, being able to look and you're taking it all in, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just trying to think when the first time I saw the Council, it probably was 84 at the Dominion. I think they did a show there. That would have been the first time. Just trying to think.
Well, I tell you what, let me grab off the shelf here. The Style Council, Mr. Cool's Dream, 1984. This is his very special magazine, and we can look it up. So, Council Meetings Part 1 would have been, when were that? Started in Chippenham, Gold Diggers, 10th of March.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
London Dominion. So there were two dates, actually, 14th and 15th. 15th was on BBC Radio. And I feel like this was the same. I feel like that was the same date. Would that have been the same date? I feel like that was the same date that Café Blur came out. That Style Council debut album. How surprising was that first album then? So around that time, that first gig, you're also digging into their first LP, which is very different, is very diverse. And Paul was hardly singing on the first side.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm an Essex boy. Our car was living in Romford at the time. And I can remember when that came out, Café Blur, I went to Romford Marketplace, which Our Price Records was just off there. And I bought it and I jumped on the bus on it, put it on the record player, as it was called in them days. I remember sitting there like poring over the album sleeve, listening and for kind of scratching my head a little bit, thinking, you know, he's going to sing in a minute, surely, you know. And so it took a good few listens. You know, obviously, you know, you kind of gravitate towards one or two tracks that stand out initially. A Gospel, I can remember that coming on and thinking, no, this is so far removed from the Jam.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be any further, really, from
polar
opposites in a way.
I think that was intentional, you know. I think he intended to, he said it then himself, and to put a lot of distance between what he did in the Jam and the new stuff. But that was even that was a surprise, you know. That was, but the standout tracks, The Whole Point of No Return and Ever Changing Moods, You're the Best Thing. There were some ones that, again, we talked about just a little while ago, those strong melodies, they jumped straight out, you know, and fantastic songs. So the others took a couple of listens, you know, and so this day, you know, you know, there's a few tracks on there, one or two that I'm not so keen on, like anyone. When you think 40 years ago, and we're still listening, you know, you're still listening to those songs and they sound as good today as they did then. You know, I've been listening a little bit to, Absolute Radio 80s. And some of the stuff that comes on there sounds just so dated. Now, Howard Jones came on and some things like that. And I'm listening to the sounds that they chose to use on the tracks and thinking this couldn't have been made in any other time. You listen to Ever Changing Moods and You're the Best Thing. They could have been made 3 years ago. I think that's what sets Paul apart. You know, he's got a timeless kind of aspect to his songwriting, which, yeah, not many other people can match.
The other thing throughout the Style Council's career is this honorary counsellor. So initially the band was Paul and Mick. It was a duo. And I think actually the contract with Polydor, from the sounds of things, was a Paul Weller solo contract from everything I've read. But it was basically Paul and Mick, and all the advertising right at the beginning, all the marketing was Paul and Mick. But the honorary counselors, so Steve White initially, D was an honorary counselor initially before they became full-time members of the band, if you like. But all the way through, these honorary counselors are adding so much to the music. And there was a lovely moment last summer where you played Brighton. You played the exhibition, Nicky Weller's exhibition. And a bunch of the honorary counselors performed with you as well, right?
They did, yeah. That was a bit special, yeah. It was Jay, Ella Ruth.
Jay Williams.
Jay Williams, yeah. She came down. I gave her a call, and she agreed straight away. Yeah, she said, I'd love to do it. Camille, he agreed straight away. And Steve Sedelnik, we'd spoke before because we'd played the 100 Club before lockdown, and he came along with Nicky. Wait, back in the early days when we first kicked off, he came along. So he was kind of in touch. So I pinged him a message, said, would you fancy it? And he agreed. He'd struck up a kind of, say, friendship at that point. Dan, our percussion player, had hooked up with Steve and had some conversations with him about percussion and drumming. And so he had a rapport with Steve, and he pinged him a message, said, you know, is it a definite? Can you make it? So Steve said, yeah, I'd love to come along. And then on the day, the guys just came along. We said, you know, how do you want to play it? Jake was up for singing the whole set, pretty much.
Brilliant.
And Camille and Steve said, we'll sit back and let you guys do your thing, and we'll perhaps come on in the encore and do a couple of tunes there, which they did.
Was there any proper rehearsal or any time?
No,
with them?
Not at all.
None at all. Wow.
No. Camille messaged me and said, what song should we do? So I said, well, we do pretty much everything that you did at the time. You know, what do you fancy? And I think it was, he particularly wanted to do Walls. He wanted to do Head Start for Happiness and The Lodgers, he was keen to do. I said, like, there's the Home and Abroad album. I said, like, they're your versions on there. You're on it. Just have a listen to them, and we'll stick to that arrangement. So we'll play that arrangement. If you just freshen up on the part that you play on that, we'll hook up and run it on the day. So we did. You know, we might have run them through in soundcheck, one of the tunes. It was a bit of a sight to look round and see Camille on the bass, you know, like just where he would have been 35 years ago. It was, yeah. And look across and see Jay and then Steve on the percussion. Yeah, it was a nice touch. I really appreciate the guys coming down, and I think they enjoyed it. You know, they said they enjoyed it. So,
Yeah, it's interesting because I was looking at the, there was like a Style Council in Concert live album. And when you look at the front cover, it's literally, you know, Paul Weller, Mick Talbert, DC Lee, Steve White mentioned. But actually on half the tracks, it's not D, it's J. And it's a bit weird because, right, I think it's almost a bit where she's kind of been rewritten out of Style Council history in a way. But that first kind of 18 months, it was very much a solid part of the band. Her and Paul, you know, a lot of the videos that we've, you know, the live videos we've got from that time, J was a massive part of that band.
Certainly. She was at Chippenham, wasn't she? And then I think she went to Japan. She was telling us she went to
Japan. The Far East, Far Out videos. Far East, Far Out,
yeah.
J, yeah.
Yeah, she did. And she's gone on to do, she's gone on to work with some serious people. I don't know if she, have you had her?
Yeah, own? Yeah, she was great. She was lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. She's gone on to work with some serious people. She was lovely. You know, she just come along and just had a great time. It was lovely to see. Yeah.
Now, for you with the band, so when was it? It was 2013. So we're 10 years in now, are we?
2013 was when I had the idea. The first show or gig we did would have been July 2014. Yeah, so that 6 months I was kind of putting the band together. And the trickiest part was finding brass players. I wouldn't call it a closed shop. But if you don't know any, it's a bit of an uphill struggle trying to find brass players. You know, I was looking in the music directories, getting in touch with people, and, you know, and they were saying, yeah, we'll have a go. And they turn out to be, you know, kind of school concert players. Didn't work out. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, I got in touch with a couple of people who were in the BBC orchestra, and they wanted 500 quid a rehearsal each.
I'm guessing you know those
really out of our budget. Yeah, so we'll give them a swerve for now. And it was my wife that had the idea. She said, why don't you try the local kind of woodwind and brass shop, a place that sells trumpets, you know, why don't you try there? So I did. I popped in and I said, do you know any brass players? And the guy said, yeah, you need trumpet Trev. Still makes me laugh now. I definitely need trumpet Trev. Where's he live? So he put us in touch, and sure enough, Trev Irving, who's still our trumpet player now, him and a couple of the guys that he'd played with over the years They kind of raised their eyebrows when I first showed them what I wanted to do. I said, this is the plan. And they kind of raised their eyebrows and kind of had a little chuckle. But then they came to a rehearsal and we played through a few of the tracks. They kind of got it. And we've been together ever since, you know, and it's...
And am I right in thinking they play with Bad Manners as well?
Dave well on trombone. He still goes out occasionally with Doug. Tony Arden on sax and Trev, they spent a big part of their musical career touring with Bad Manners, and they've got some fantastic stories, which I won't repeat here, you know.
The flavour of those is like, yeah.
Yeah, I bet. But they're great players and they're great lads.
And the thing is with the brass section, I mean, how important was that to the Style Council in those early days? I mean, goodness me. I mean, Stuart Prosser has been on the podcast recently, Hilary Robertson. In fact, I think most of the horn section have all been on now. The thing about your band is you've got that sound, that replication, it's on point. You've clearly worked to that to get that. But
definitely.
How much does that evolve and become your own versus imitation?
My approach to things, Dan, is all or nothing. If I don't see a lot of point in doing it, if you can't give it everything you got, you know, and do it to the best of your ability, there's no point. So when the guys come along and Tony writes out most of the parts on sax, and he'll write the, if we say we're going to do this tune, he'll write the parts, he'll listen to all the different versions, he'll write the parts out, then we'll, you know, in a sound check, we'll run the parts and he'll say, what do you think? And we'll, you know, kind of mull it over until it's perfect, until we're happy with it. And he's done some cracking arrangements. I mean, he's put some brass onto a tune called Luck. Off of our favourite shop, he's wrote a brass part for that, which now it seems weird playing the song without it.
And he's So you're adding brass to songs that didn't have brass back in the day.
Not for the sake of it, not for tune, you know. But certain ones we think it'll work. You know, we've tried some and it don't work. So you know, and Long Hot Summer, there's an arrangement we've done just to bring it a little bit into the 21st century, so it comes across a little bit better live. There's a brass part at the end of that Tony's wrote. And embellish, but for the others, Head Start of Happiness, Walls, you know, that they have got to be exactly right, or as close as we can get them. You know, I mean, I'm not sure you can say 100%, but as close as you can possibly get it, that's important to us, because, like you say, they're iconic parts of the tracks, and you know, it makes the difference getting it right, to me anyway.
And obviously, so much of the live experience is about performance. How much of it is in your heads? Talk me through Mick and Steve White and D as well. But you're Paul Weller. Yeah, how much of it are you trying to channel what he delivered in that band as a performer versus actually this is just you performing the songs? I mean, you're not an impersonator, obviously. This is not Stars in Their Eyes. But at the same time, are you, you know, that look and feel and how he performs and the likewise from Mick and all that? Is that part of the concept?
Well, Paul's got a particular style, so I wouldn't go out for, you know, putting a wig on. But, you know, the Style Council dressed in a certain way, you know, so we dress in that kind of flavour. And Paul played the guitar in a certain way, and he sung the songs in a certain way. So I try to replicate rather than imitate. I try to replicate the melody that he sings, because that's what people want to hear. They want to hear the melody as they remember it. Hmm. There's nothing worse than hearing Elton John sing a song that he wrote, you know, 30 years ago and singing it in his new style, you know, and you think...
You hate that as well, yeah.
Where's
yeah,
he going too. With that, you know?
Yeah.
That irritates me. So I would imagine that people want to hear the songs as Paul sung them. So I try to put the songs across as Paul did without, you know, getting into the kind of imitation, you know. I try to replicate what he did. And likewise on the guitar, he's got a particular guitar style that can be quite aggressive. And to get the sound and the output that he delivered, you got to kind of give it a little bit of effort. Mm. You know? So yeah, I try to replicate what he did, you know, without being a cringy, you know, imitator, if you like, you know, because I don't know Paul from Adam, you know, I've kind of met him in passing once. It's not really my thing to go kind of meeting him. We might not get on. You know, I like Paul's music. You know, we might not get on, you know. So I wouldn't go and seek him out and say, oh, I like your stuff, mate. You know, it's not really me. It's just the same way you wouldn't come and seek me out and go, oh, Dow, I like your electrical work. You know, he would seek me out and pray.
Well, he's very impressive there, Darren. You shouldn't understate that, you know.
Yeah, you know, so I'll let him live his life and I appreciate the music he puts out. You know, that's how I kind of see it.
But there were times, obviously, in those early days as well, where Paul, you mentioned playing the guitar, Paul's packed the guitar away. It's in a box behind the stage, it's back in at home or whatever, and it's just him with the microphone, usually with a big long lead and quite a bit of dancing. So is that, was that ever a consideration?
Not really. Not for me. No, my dancing won't, you know, is not good enough to do indoors, let alone.
But they used, I mean, him and Dee particularly, there was a lot of busting out some moves, wasn't there?
Yeah, that's one aspect that I can't replicate. Yeah, sadly. So. Yeah.
Now, there's obviously only one Steve White. There's only one Mick Talbot. There's only one DC Lee. So let's talk through those members of your band. And I mean, Steve White's an incredible drummer, isn't he? I mean, goodness me. And yeah, and he's such a huge part of Paul as well as solo sound for so long as well. Yeah. How did you find your Steve White?
There's a lad called Craig Reed, who is, by the way, a fantastic drummer. Relatively young lad, early 30s. He's a lovely fella and a great player. Him and Al, the bass player, who is another tremendous player, by the way. They lock together. And without those two, we wouldn't be half the band we are, you know, if they are so tight together. But Craig, he's not Steve White. He's the first to admit he'll perform the songs in the way that comes across as if it was Steve White playing. Steve's an exceptional drummer. There's probably not another drummer like Steve, but if you've seen Craig play, there's no room for criticism, you know, and say, you know, he's not up to the job. He is by a mile. Fantastic player. He wasn't the first drummer that we had. Initially, I put an advert out for a jazz drummer and a guy came along who was very, very jazz influenced. And he played a couple of shows with us, but it wasn't really for him. He didn't really fancy committing to it. He ran a drum school. He had some other issues where he couldn't devote the time to it. So we were on the lookout for someone else, and Craig came along.
Does he get his Steve White moments? Does he get the dropping bombs on the White House solos?
Yeah, we do a medley. We do the Money Go Round medley from Home and Abroad, where it goes from Money Go Round into Soul Deep, into Strength of Your Nature. There's some breaks in there, some drum breaks in there that, you know, he plays and does a fantastic job of it. Yeah, I've got to say.
Let's talk Mick Talbot as well, because actually thinking, we were talking about Cafe Blur, I mean, all the little Mick ditties, the, you know, starting with Mick's Blessing, Mick's Up we had, and, you know, throughout the whole Style Council, all that kind of stuff as well, those instrumentals were also such a key part of the Style Council live too. Talk to me about Mick in your band.
Up until recently, probably a year ago, my pal Steve Hayes was played the Mick part. He formed the band with me back in the early part of 2014. Great voice. He did a fantastic job of Homebreakers, and he's kind of background was a solo pianist, used to do a lot of cruises, very accomplished pianist and vocalist, great voice. So he played all the Mick parts up until recently, when he sadly decided that life was getting in the way a little bit. So he had to take the decision to step aside for personal reasons. So our other keyboard player, Keith, stepped up, who is a bit of a maestro on the choir. Very, very accomplished pianist. And we started to bring in things like Mick's Blessings. So now in our current set, he does a little rendition of Mick's Blessings, which goes down great.
That's not an easy one to play, though, that is.
No,
it?
No.
I mean, it's only, what, a minute, 20 seconds, something like that?
Yeah, but it's a very tricky tune to play. He smashes it, you know, and it goes down well. It goes down well. It's a nice kind of interlude in the set, you know, and it's...
Brilliant. Oh. Yeah, and then great. Talk to me about, this is Danny Clay, your DC.
Danny Clay. Yeah, what can I say about Danny? Fantastic. She's a superstar, really. She really is. Yeah, she's really the star of the band. Fantastic voice. She nails it every night. What else can I say? Yeah.
There are moments, obviously, as well, where the interesting thing is Style Council, it's not obviously it's a Paul Weller band and he's writing the lyrics more often than not. Every member of the Style Council had their moment to shine on different songs, didn't they? And there are elements where Dee took the limelight live and on record and Paul kind of stepped back and it was her vocals and stuff like that. So if you're part of a band, the four of you having your different moments must be really cool and really exciting to be part of a band. It's not like you're never background in the Style Council, are you?
No, that's right. Danny, she takes the lead on Paris Match. And obviously there's the interplay on things like Head Start, where, you know, we do a verse each. Big Boss, there's that question and answer kind of thing, which works really well. Like I say, Keith does his solo bit. You know, everyone has a chance to shine, even down on percussion. There's instrumental breaks. He's got the band nicknamed him Salad some years back, because when he first came on board, somebody said, why are we bothering with a percussion player? It's like salad. You can kind of take it or leave it. You know, you don't really need it. So Then he came on stage and we played the show. And then afterwards, the guy that said it said, I've got to take that back. It's unbelievable what it adds. You know, and Dan is truly a fan. Again, I keep saying it, but, and I'm not just saying this. They are all fantastic players. Dan is no exception, but he's affectionately known as Salad in the band.
I never even knew I loved Salad, but now I'm. Now look, I mentioned on social media that we were chatting and some of the fans got in touch. Okay. So let me ask some of these questions. All right. So this is Joe Nellis on Twitter. It says, great band. They have a very authentic sound. Can you ask Daz what Style Council song is the most difficult to replicate and capture the energy of the Style Council's live stage sound on? So this is not just what's difficult to say, but to really get the Style Council feel across, the sound of it across. What's difficult?
What's a difficult one? Sometimes it goes down well, I guess. I guess Money Go Round, we kind of do two verses, two choruses, and then go into Soul Deep. Sometimes when we're playing, and it's different every night, of course, in a live context, but some nights that feels electric when you kick off with that. And some nights, not so much. And you kind of feel yourself, I need to step this up, you know, and give this a little bit more grunt, you know. But I guess that's the same with any band. But that one, it really does depend on the bass sound and how heavy the drums are in the mix, because it's bass and drums heavy, as you know. And if the out front sound isn't up to scratch, that is the first song to suffer, I would say.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because so much of it being in a band and performing live is about confidence as well, isn't it? And it's like, you know, if you're not, how's it going to go?
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much of a worry these days, having played them songs so much. But what affects it for me is the sound. You know, that we could be playing to kind of 500 people or 50. If the sound on stage, and I guess every musician will tell you this, if the sound on stage is brilliant, you'll have a great time. If it's poor, you'll probably struggle. You won't enjoy it. Certainly I don't, you know, as much. You know, the crowd might be really into it. They might be having a great time, but it won't be as enjoyable for me, because if the sound's not as good as it can be, it affects me. I guess that's true with any musician, you know.
There are songs in Paul Weller's set list now where, and we were talking about this on the podcast a couple of weeks back, where if he were to drop them, people would be almost kind of outraged, right? And it's kind of, you know, it's such a massive back catalogue. But for him, singing things like, you know, You Do Something to Me and Wildwood and Into Tomorrow, people are like, oh, he didn't play Malice, for instance, and stuff like that. What's the one that you cannot drop from your Style Council set? If you never played it, people will be like, what?
It's either Shout to the Top or Walls Come Tumbling Down. When you play those, you can see that they instantly catch people's attention. Even if you're at a festival where it's a lovely sunny afternoon and people are chilling to You're the Best Thing, and then you play, you know, they'll just be sitting watching, you know, and then you play those two songs and it has a reaction, you know, it creates a reaction. 9 times out of 10, yeah.
Right, Jed Life says, I don't watch too many tribute gigs personally, but I do make an exception for these guys. They're a great band. It's always lovely to hear, isn't it? Suzanne Williams said, I saw them Saturday night. Derek Rusling, so on Twitter, at the time of recording, we've just celebrated the 36th birthday of the Orange album, Cost of Loving album. He says, what's his view on that album? He said, also, I've seen you several times. I think you're brilliant. What's your view on the Orange album?
What's my view? I think it's got some great songs on it. There's some fabulous songs on it. Heavens Above, The Cost of Loving Itself. I like it. Fairy Tales is a cracker. Yeah, we play several of those. Not all the time. You know, we try to vary it a little bit. It got some bad press, didn't it? That album. And I'm not sure if I agree. You know, you're either a Style Council fan or you're not. You know, that's not to say that you've got to like everything. I think on the whole, it's, you know, it's not their best album, but it's got some cracking songs on it.
It's really interesting with the Style Council when you think about it. I remember Ian Munn, Mr. Cool's Dream, who I do have a question from, which I'll share with you in a second. But I remember him saying about when he first created that first book, nobody was really interested in the Style Council. It was because of how it ended, maybe, or Paul's solo career launching, whatever. It was like something people didn't kind of necessarily talk about being a big fan. Whereas now, people really do talk about that band being very special, and retrospectively now talking about those albums, those singles again. But there was a time where if you'd have launched this band maybe in 2001, it wouldn't be where it is now, I don't think, do you?
Probably not. And I think that's a general thing, Dan. I mean, if you go back 20 years, you know, the likes of The Alarm weren't touring, From the Jam weren't touring, Bad Manners weren't touring. All these bands that have come back to do, you know, retrospective tours, it was a kind of lull. in the kind of music industry, at the end of Oasis, when all the guitar bands kind of died out, live music seemed to take a big dip, if memory serves. So you're right. And it's a resurgence of late, yeah, in the last 10 years, where all these bands have come back on the circuit, and you can go and see Feel Goods, or you can go and see, like I say, From the Jam, all these bands that from the 80s, you can go and see them again, and they put on a fantastic show. Nine Below Zero, The Truth have been treading the boards. And lots of these bands that we watched back in the old days are back now. So I think it was a general thing, not just a Style Council thing. I think it was a general live music scene thing. It died out, you know, at that time.
There was also a period, I think, even like, you think like late 80s, early 90s, it wasn't cool to like the Beatles. Like the Beatles are like, really the Beatles, you know, which just seems
bizarre.
Cycles, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mr. Cool's Dreams, Ian Munn, Mr. Cool's Dreams, his question says, ask Darren about his collection of authentic guitars and pedals.
That's a weird one coming from Ian. Yeah, that's a weird one.
What have you got? Anything? What's the answer to that question?
Well, I don't know how many people would be interested in that kind of thing.
Look, hey, if it's only Ian, that's fine with me, because
he's
a god for the Style Council point of view, right?
Well, as we kind of mentioned earlier, all or nothing, that kind of ethos spreads to equipment as well. So I've got a 60s Epiphone Casino, which is a signature Style Council guitar. I've got some old Vox Lead 100 amps that Paul used, and some old 80s Boss pedals, the CE2 chorus pedals. I've got a 70s Ricky Maple Glow 12 string that he used. You know, you'll see it on that video, Showbiz. Yeah, a 70s Telecaster that he used. Kind of the guitars that he used at the time, I've kind of over the years tracked them down and picked them up where I can to use live. You know, I've got a deep bodied jazz guitar. I got a Yamaha. I think it's an AE 1200 that Paul used in the middle part of the Style Council, the big jazz, and an Aria Herb Ellis jazz kind of, you know, box. Yeah. So the guitars that he used, I try to get hold of if I can.
Have you got the Wham one? What was that? That was Milton Keynes.
The Wham. That was an old Ricky. I sold that. Yeah. So that was an old Ricky 330 with the artwork on the front. Yeah. I did have one at one time. Yeah. I'll let that go though.
Yeah, with a tear in his eye, folks. Well, look, if we've still got any listeners left after that Muso info, let me ask you about the documentary, because obviously fairly recently, what was it, Tail End of COVID 2, I think, the sequel, we had that Style Council documentary. Mm. And actually, Paul gets asked all the time, you know, would you get the Jam back together? Nobody's ever asked him, would you get the Style Council back together? And there's so many people that actually would much rather see that. And we saw it. There it was, the end of that documentary, the four of them playing a song together, wasn't it lovely?
Brilliant. Yeah. Well, a great arrangement of that track. Yeah. Brilliant.
I'm assuming that was as much a surprise to you as it was to the rest of us. Or had you had a leak? Had you heard about it?
No. We was, the guys that made that film, Mark and Lee, they had contacted us some 6 months prior to that airing and asked if they could come to one of our shows and film us, with the possible intention of putting some, you know, some clips into the back end of the documentary. So they did. They came along to the 100 Club the summer before the launch of that. They filmed us, but sadly, I think they said they took 24 hours of footage or something like that. Something mad.
Nuts. How you cut those things down, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it just, you know, with the content, the Mark said to me, when Paul agreed to do that song at the end, he said, that's kind of where your bit wouldn't fit it in. He said, and he goes, if a choice between the two, you know, it's like, I completely understand why you went with Paul instead of me. But yeah. So it was a privilege to be asked for the, you know, in the first place, and for the guys to come down and take some footage of us. Yeah. Very grateful for that opportunity, just to have the chance.
And I imagine that documentary, well, I wonder if it did a few things. I mean, one, it heightened interest in the band, the Style Council, even more than before. And already, I think it was on a bit of a surge around that time too. But suddenly your band is also popularity alongside that there must have been a knock-on effect of that, I would have thought. But the other thing I find really interesting would be probably true of Paul solo as well, right? So there's lots of Style Council songs in Weller's solo set list these days. And that performance there with the four of them together, does that influence any of what you're doing as a band? Do you see him doing solo stuff and think, oh, that's a different way of presenting it? Or that arrangement you mentioned there with the four of them back in the room together for the documentary, does that influence, you know, those influences come back into your band at all?
The only time it has is the Long Hot Summer arrangement. I think I heard an arrangement he did. It would have been about 92, 93, early, very early doors in his solo career. He did a version of it where there were some nice touches in the recording, the live recording. So we kind of pulled on those to create this new arrangement. So that's the only time, I'm a little bit particular about getting the arrangements right. So I'd rather keep them as they were. Otherwise, you might as well go and see Paul do them.
That's a really good point. A few more questions from the fans. This is Laura Lakin, again, just saying how great you are. I've seen them several times, including their first gig in Brentwood. So would that have been the first one?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah. Yeah. Wow.
John Gregory, what Style Council song gives you the most pleasure as musicians to perform?
Personally, I think I really like Head Start for Happiness because of the interplay in the vocals and the verses. And it was a tricky one to learn. So it was a challenge to learn. The chords were a little bit tricky to get that. And the timing's a little bit quirky. There's some pushes and things that are not straightforward. So that I really like that one. Walls is a great one because we use it as a closer. Everyone joins in, the crowd love it. And it's just a great closer. Probably those two. Big Boss I like.
That's a good one to mention, actually, because so many of the, I think that was maybe a double A side, wasn't it? But so many of the Style Council singles had these great B-sides, didn't they?
Yes. Again, that's Paul's songwriting for you. He's got so many good songs. He can afford to put crackers on the B-side,
Are you popping Spin Drifting in your set list? Because that's a corker.
Yeah, occasionally we've played that, Spin Drifting, and Piccadilly Trail is another one that's, put in from time to time, which is another great song. Yeah, so many good songs, yeah.
Now, you're already thinking about the set list for the next year. And he's like, I've forgotten about those, yeah. So back on tour spring, I mean, when you started out, I bet you can't believe where we are now and the venues you're playing and the scale of this thing and the fact you're going on these decent-sized tours around the UK and Europe.
Amazing.
And beyond
that, right? Who would have thought? Big part of that is down to the guy that promotes us, Adrian Gibson. AGMP, he's been fantastic to us. He kind of pinged me a message, because that would have been about 2015, and he said, you fancy a one-off gig at the 100 Club? And I was kind of suspicious. I thought, I didn't know who he was at the time, so I just ignored it. And then I got another email some months later, said, do you want a gig? So I agreed, and we went along. It was really quite popular. Thursday night, I think it was. It just grew from there. We did a couple of shows with Adrian. And then he said one day, he said, do you want me to put a little tour together? He gave us some dates and we went on it. And it's just grown from there. He's been a big supporter of ours. It's a big thanks to Adrian for kind of where we are. He does a fantastic job, putting bands on.
Yeah, but also the talent in the band, right? Because it would be really easy to do this thing really badly, wouldn't it?
For a little while, yeah, you wouldn't get very far. I mean, certainly not with Adrian. If we were crap, he'd drop us.
Yeah, exactly. He's pretty high. Sure that. I know he's pretty high standards, right?
Yeah. So the fact that he stuck with us is a little bit of a boost.
Now, the other thing that you've announced as well is A Solid Bond in Your Heart, 40th anniversary tour, starting September, actually at London's 100 Club, as you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Talk to me about the idea behind that and what people can expect, because tickets on sale now, folks, and they will sell out if they haven't done already.
We like to theme the tours we do, so people kind of know what they're going to get. Obviously, it's going to be predominantly all the early stuff. With the second half, we'll have, some of the big hitters in there. But we'll be trying to replicate the sound. If you remember the Gold Diggers show, some of the tracks on there, we might put one or two of those tracks in there that will play there, those arrangements. Yeah, harking back to the early days of the Style Council, which was a great time. I've got some great memories of them early days, yeah.
Well, look, I've got some ideas for you. I mean, not that you need ideas, right? You obviously had a plan and we're seeing it through fruition, right? But there's some little thought starters for you in terms of where to take this next, right? Because, and this also just shows the experimentation of where Paul was at the time, all right? So one of these gigs, right? You need to come on first. And then we have a Billy Bragg tribute act and a Questions tribute act. And then you come on after.
Right. Yes.
Right.
Yes, yeah.
Right. They did. Okay. I don't know if you remember this. So this was Council Meetings Part 2, The Three Musketeers Go Wild. Have you heard about this? So the initial idea of this was that there was meant to be like a play beforehand. Right. And then the Style Council would perform off the back of it. And it didn't happen because apparently the guy broke his leg. I'm not sure if this was true, but it's in the programme. It's mentioned in the programme for council meetings part two. But you could dig out the scripts and you could have that. And then the other one, I think, have you ever thought of reenacting Jerusalem and doing that before you have the gig? Because that, again, was a thing. They played the whole film of Jerusalem before the live gig.
I went to the Hammersmith Odeon showing of that. Was it Hammersmith Odeon? Oh, no, or Royal Albert Hall. Oh, I can't remember now, but I remember going. But I'd probably pass on that.
Oh, actually, a fourth idea, right? For your final concert, play a load of songs that nobody's ever heard before.
Yeah. I was at that gig.
Did you rip up your program?
No, I don't remember anybody ripping their program up, to be fair. But I have got a funny memory of that program. I made my way up to the Royal Albert Hall with a pal of mine. Just on the off chance of getting a ticket, I said, should we go up and see if we can get a ticket from a tout? So he's gone, yeah, all right. So we jumped on the train, lovely summer's evening. We're hanging about outside and there's a tout there selling tickets. And he had this fella went up to him and said, have you got any single tickets, mate? Fella says, no, mate, I've got three in a row, 30 quid. He said, oh, come on, mate, I'll buy one off you. I'll give you 20 quid. So the bloke went, no, mate, it's 30 quid for the three. I'm not splitting them up. So me, brains, I said, yeah, mate, I'll have them three off you, 30 quid. So he said, all right, sells me the tickets. And I turned to the fella, I said, yeah, mate, 20 quid for a ticket. thinking I'm the brains of the outfit. He gives me the 20 quid. He looked at me like he could have killed me. So there, me and me pal got a ticket for a fiver each. We're slapping each other on the back. What a result. Goes in as a beer. Anyway, it gets close to the stage time. So we said, let's go and find our seats. So he goes up and find our seats. Who's sitting next to us? But the bloke with the ump didn't occur to me at all. And he sat there with a face like thunder for the whole night. Man, I felt so awkward all night. But I do remember the show, but I don't remember anyone tearing programs up.
Was your expectation that this would be like a greatest hit set though? Because around that time, they just
without question, I thought it was going to be, when it said review, you know, I thought it was going to be like the back catalogue show. No, sadly not. It was okay. You know, I recognised one or two tunes, but the rest was all new stuff, you know, which would have probably been better if I'd have been able to hear it a few times first, you know, which would have been nice.
And I'm guessing because a lot of that some of it was released much later. Some of it hasn't been released at all, I don't think. But yeah. I'm guessing a lot of that stuff, maybe Promised Land comes into the set list, but there's not a lot from that modernism time that comes in.
Yeah, I can't remember what the set list. I mean, there was Like a Gun was on the set list, I think.
Yes, yeah.
I think Waiting on a Connection, which was one I'd heard before. But the rest, and there was one off of, I think there was one off of The Cost of Loving on there, if memory serves. Apart from that, Changing the Guard, I think, might have been on the set list. But apart from that, it was all new stuff.
And obviously the album Modernism doesn't get released at the time, does later on the box set and stuff, and the band fizzles out. Were you that? I mean, how did you feel? Were you? I mean, obviously you didn't know at that point that you're going to be in the Style Council. This wasn't a dream in your head. But how did you feel about the end of that band? It wasn't the same explosive finish as the Jam. It fizzled out more, didn't it?
It was one of those, if I remember rightly, I think it was a little bit of a disappointment. Oh, well, that's a shame, kind of, rather than, oh no, what am I going to do next? You know, which is what a lot of the Jam fans tend to remember feeling. Oh, Shane, you know, he was distraught when he went at the end of the Jam.
Don't bring it up again. You'll be listening to this. You'll set him off.
I don't remember feeling that way. It was just one of those things, you know, it fizzles out, you know, bands come, bands go kind of thing, you know, just move on. And it was, it was a little bit of wilderness. And then, you know, obviously Paul came back and I think I was sitting in the car out in the countryside somewhere when I heard Wild Wood or Into Tomorrow, one of those tracks. Yeah. And I thought, blimey, he's back big time. It wasn't the shock that Jam fans kind of remember.
You mentioned that first band and how you were playing Jam songs and then Style Council songs and all that kind of stuff. But obviously, at the minute, you can't play it. You know, it's not like you can put a Jam track. He never played any Jam songs in the Style Council. And obviously, there weren't any Weller solo songs at that time, obviously. Sure. But you can't put any of these songs in your set list. The only one that he did through all those three iterations was Move On Up, which I know you do play at times.
Yeah, we've played that once or twice, yeah.
But there must be songs where you go, oh, that's such a brilliant solo song. Wouldn't it be great to perform that? There must be songs you're like, bloody hell, because there are songs that sound very Style Council-y in style.
Yeah,
even think about like On Sunset as an album. There are songs where you could hear the Style Council doing those.
Yeah, sometimes.
Is it tempting?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I love Into Tomorrow. playing that live. That's a great live track, particularly with the brass at the end. I could see us playing that, you know. When you're driving along and you know, one comes on the radio and you think that, you know, that's a cracker. It'd be nice to put that in. It would really go down well. Changing Man would always goes down well, you know. It always used to go down well in pubs, that's for sure.
Well, look, maybe that's a future project, but for now, we're loving the Style Counselors. Honestly, man, the amount of people who are saying on social media how much they're looking forward to hearing you, how much they're looking forward to seeing you live this spring, later on this year as well. Thanks for joining me, man. I've got two final questions for you. As you'll know, probably, fingers crossed, because you've missed the podcast, right? So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam. It could be The Style Council. I don't know. I mean, I think you're kind of into them. Or it could be Paul Weller solo. What are you going to go with?
One song. I think it'd be Changing Man. That's such a great track, melodically, I think. When you hear that, when that strikes up, whether it be in the arena where he's playing or in the venue, or even on the radio, you know, straight away it gets your attention. It's got to be the one, I think, for me.
I'm surprised, actually, because that hasn't been mentioned a huge amount of times on this podcast. And it is an absolute killer tune, isn't it?
It is, yeah. There's probably a few that would say it's overplayed. He plays it all the time.
It does seem to be the only song that Absolute Radio play a Paul Weller solo.
Yeah.
Or You Do Something to Me maybe as well, right? But yeah. Final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet lovely people like yourself, to hear your stories of your love of Paul's music, your connections, and obviously to hear about the Style Counselors has been brilliant. But the whole purpose of this podcast is for me to get the interview with Paul Weller. It's the interview I never managed during my radio career. It never became an option. If it happens off the back of this podcast, what should I ask him?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. What should you ask him?
What would you like to know?
What would I like to know? Well, as I said before, you know, I'm kind of not, I don't know him from Adam, you know, and I'm not really one to pry. It'd probably be something about, you know, how did you get that sound on one of your records? You know, how did you get the guitar sound on one of your tracks? Yeah, I can't think of a specific, but there's been times where I think, I wonder how he did that. I wonder if he used the pedal. I wonder if he did this. I wonder if he did that. Yeah, but I guess that'll stay a mystery.
He probably won't remember, right?
Yeah, probably not. Yeah, and he's not really one, from what I've heard, but, you know, he's forthcoming with that kind of information. But one thing I'd love to know, does he have some of the old guitars that he used to use in the Style Council? And if so, is he willing to sell any of them? So that would be my question. If you got anything from the Style Council left over, would you be prepared to sell it?
Well, first dibs, yeah. Well, I'll pass that on, man. Darren, thank you so much for your time. I really love chatting with you. Good luck with what's next, and we'll see you on the road in 2023, man.
Brilliant. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for your time. Cheers, mate.
My thanks once again to Darren Fletcher, the Style Counselors, the one and only tribute to the Style Council. What a joy to chat with him about his career and the band and the influence that the Style Counselors had on him and his life. Check out the show notes for this podcast, paulwellerfanpodcast.com, for all the details about those tour dates that I mentioned as well. And make sure you get to see the Style Counselors live in 2023. Don't forget, whilst you're on the website, you can pop into my store as well. All our merchandise in there, t-shirts for the summer, your tote bags, your mug, and you can also buy a virtual coffee as well. Doing exactly that over the past week, thanks you to Ian Hamilton. Hello, sir. Hi to Cookie. Says, just discovered your Paul Weller podcast. Great stuff. Thumbs up. Well, welcome on board, Cookie. Hi to Russell Cox. Says, too many great episodes recently to pick just one. Have heard more new music and fresh stories via your brilliant podcast than any other source. Thanks, Dan. Well, cheers, Russell. Much appreciated. And thanks to you for your virtual coffee. Hello to Stephen McAllenon. Cheers to you for your generosity. Thank you so much. Hello to Alex McLaughlin, who says, I love the Andy Rosen chat, especially the unseen photos. That shot of Weller and Buckler post-Brighton gig must be one of the last of those two taken together. That you're probably right, actually. Hello to Grant. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hey, Duncan, who says, great work, Dan, mate. Keep on keeping on. Hope to see you again soon. Hi to Ian. Hello, Sean Wilson. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee and your generosity as well. You can get involved on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Now, here's something else I want you to do, okay? Make sure you're continuing to spread the word, social media, your Paul Weller loving mates, the Jam fans, the Style Council. Spread the word. It's always much appreciated. You can get in touch on Twitter at WellerFanPod, or if you just search on Facebook and Instagram, Paul Weller Fan Podcast, you can get in touch there as well. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president. You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.